You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. The tiny and tony city-state of Monaco sits on the French Riviera, less than a square mile, tucked between the glittering Mediterranean and the mountains. It's a place where people try to make a fortune in the casinos or hide their fortunes in banks. Luke Harding, a reporter for The Guardian, came here to track down a Russian woman named Svetlana Krivonogik.
Her story is like something out of a fairy tale. It's a bit like a kind of post-communist version of Cinderella. Svetlana was a sort of business student. She worked as a cleaner in the 1990s in St. Petersburg. And she grew up in a communal apartment, sharing a bathroom and a kitchen with four other families. And then suddenly she meets Prince Charming. Except Prince Charming isn't actually, I mean, he doesn't arrive on a horse or in a carriage. He's actually a rather dour KGB officer called Vladimir Putin. And Svetlana goes from being a cleaner to suddenly having kind of huge assets. She acquires property, she acquires shares in St. Petersburg's leading bank called Bank Rossiya.
And she acquires a $4 million seaside property in Monaco, all set up through secret offshore bank accounts.
The reason for her sudden sort of transformation from rags to riches is because she forms a very close friendship with Vladimir Putin. And the allegation, which has been published by the Russian media, hasn't been formally denied by the Kremlin, is that she became Putin's lover.
Luke says he didn't travel all the way to Monaco to get salacious details about the Russian president's alleged love life.
What's important about this story is what I think it tells us about state corruption and the fact that Putin and the people around him became fantastically rich, even more rich once he became president. And we see his lover, I think now former lover, we see his friends, we see people from his childhood who go from nothing to suddenly being worth hundreds and millions of dollars.
Svetlana's rags-to-riches tale is just one example of the type of financial maneuvering that's helped world leaders, industry magnates, and celebrities hide billions in wealth, most recently exposed in one of the biggest data leaks in history, known as the Pandora Papers.
The Pandora Papers are a mega leak of more than 12 million documents from a bunch of what you might call financial service providers, people who open or manage offshore accounts run by a whole galaxy of individuals. I mean, some of them famous, some of them not. But what they do, I would say, kind of collectively, is they shine light on a secret financial world used by many people, including some politicians. It's a sort of shadow world, actually. And what's interesting for me personally is that the offshore world is not what I once thought, not a small part of our kind of global financial system. Basically, it is the system.
This week, we explore what the Pandora Papers reveal about a shadowy global financial system that's helped make Vladimir Putin one of the wealthiest and most powerful men in the world. When the Pandora Papers first emerged, what was astonishing to me was the sheer volume combined with the sheer audacity of being able to tap into this many databases and coordinate the release of this much stuff on these many people. It's breathtaking, really, its scope.
The scope is enormous, as you say, but also as a piece of investigative endeavor, it really is crazily big. We're talking about more than 600 journalists with a whole range of media publications. The project was coordinated by the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists in Washington, D.C. They did a fantastic job, but we did have a database, so I could take your name, for example, Ray, and I could put it in, and I could see if you secretly, unknown to your colleagues, own offshore companies. I could probably find your passport, emails, correspondence, and so on. And so, to be clear, our focus was not on, you know, randomly hitting on people. It was looking primarily at politicians, elected individuals, people who had a kind of platform in society and politics and hadn't necessarily declared their own financial interests. What you have to understand is what the offshore world sells is secrecy. I mean, if, Ray, for example, you want to buy a mansion in London next to Buckingham Palace where the royal family live, you can buy it as Ray. You can buy it in your name. Or you can do what many of the people found in the Pandora Papers, which is to call your accountant, who will basically get in touch with an offshore service provider. They will set up an offshore company, let's say in the British Virgin Islands, and that will in turn have shares owned in it by a further offshore company. And essentially, you will then buy the sort of luxurious multi-million dollar property next to Buckingham Palace, but your name won't appear anywhere. And that's the point, is that you can acquire assets, whether it's art, property, yachts, real estate in Florida or in Malibu or wherever. And we, ordinary citizens, we don't know about that. And okay, if you're a successful rich person, you might argue that that's legitimate. But if, for example, you're a public official or a politician or a civil servant and you do that, then that looks pretty iffy, as we say in Britain.
Let's talk about Monaco. Are there any transparency laws? Are there any transaction laws that make the normal spade work of reporting, the normal public reporting requirements of registry of transactions and that sort of thing worth doing there?
Yeah, the English novelist P.G. Wodehouse, he famously described Monaco, this sort of tax haven overlooking the Mediterranean, he called it a sunny place for shady people. And I would say it's impossible without a leak of the scale to get any kind of ingress, because you can wander around. I mean, I went out there with the Washington Post, with colleagues from the BBC, and we did the rounds. We went to the yacht club, we went to the marina, we went to the building, knocked on the door of Svetlana Krivonogic in this luxury apartment that she owned, and another woman opened the door. It wasn't her. And you can see the wealth. I mean, it's you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes. There are people driving Ferraris. There are women in jewels and slightly older men, you know, in very expensive sunglasses wherever you look. And if you try and go past the Hotel de Paris too close, that someone will basically literally shoo you away because they've clocked you as being someone of no significance and no wealth. I mean, I'm quite a scruffy guy. I mean, obviously, I'm not a high-rolling tourist. So you've got the optics of it, but basically Monaco thrives because it's secret. And one thing I picked up from talking to a few you know, people who were willing to talk with me is that in recent years it's become Moscow on sea. I mean, the point is that unless you're French, there are no questions asked. You can bring in your money. I mean, you can literally bring in suitcases of money. You can deposit it in banks. You can find offshore firms and basically exit from taxation. I mean, it's a very alluring package if you're very rich.
The wealth that has been created in mysterious ways, let's say, in Russia in the last quarter of a century is breathtaking in its scale. But when I was in Russia in the early 90s, I was talking to all these technocrats who were trying to figure out how to take the state out of the Russian economy and give all that wealth to the people and create a shareholder society. Well, now we know that didn't happen. And the state's wealth, the management and ownership of all these enormous enterprises created by the USSR, ended up in the hands of a relatively tiny bunch of people. Putin didn't stop this from happening. He seems to have supercharged it.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, Ray. I mean, I agree with your analysis. And basically, 21st century Russia is feudal in character or neo-feudal. And strategic assets, whether it's oil or gas or minerals, controlled by a small group of families, with Putin at the top, at the apex of the system, as the ultimate oligarch. Now, I mean, To be clear, if you're there are sort of genuine entrepreneurs and business people in Russia, but the difference with the US is that if you're a Russian oligarch and the phone rings and it's the presidential administration and you are told to buy a yacht for Putin or build a soccer stadium, or spend money to influence a foreign election as part of a kind of an espionage project, I mean, there's only one answer to that phone call. The answer is yes, you do it. And so oligarchs are in a sort of superposition. I mean, they're both sort of independent entrepreneurs and they are emissaries of the state. And this isn't always understood in the US or the UK. When oligarchs turn up, they speak perfect English these days. They love their children. They read novels. They probably love their pets. You know, they're interesting, rounded people. But also, ultimately, they know that if they want to keep their assets in Russia, whether it's a sort of, you know, whether it's a cobalt fortune or an oil well or whatever, they have to obey the state and play by Putin's rules. And Putin, ultimately, his wealth is Russia's wealth. And if you were to go to New York, to Wall Street and knock on every door and say, do you have a bank account in the name of Vladimirovich Putin? You know, the teller would check and go, look, I'm terribly sorry, Ray. We don't have a Mr. Putin here. That's not how it works. What it works is there are a series of proxies for Putin, some of whom we found in the Pandora Papers, who hold his fortune. And it's a kind of team. It's a team of people, some of them very famous, whose names I won't say in case there are any lawyers listening. But this is well understood in the Russian elite. And Putin, he's the richest guy in the world. I mean, I don't want to shock you, but, you know, formally, his assets are very modest. His salary is $200,000 a year. But informally, he can command, use many billions of dollars. We're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars that he and his team are collectively worth after two decades in power. And I know Donald Trump is rich or claims to be rich, but Vladimir Putin is far, far, far richer.
You've been watching this go on for a long time, both inside and outside Russia. Were there missing pieces of the puzzle of how this all works that the Pandora Papers helped fill in for you?
Yes. Yes, and yes, because this is a secretive regime that lies pretty much about everything, but is particularly defensive and twitchy about its private financial interests. And so with the Panama Papers, we found a cellist called Sergei Roldugin linked to about $2 billion in offshore deals. And Roldugin, we'd never really heard of, but it turned out that he was Putin's best friend from Leningrad, someone who lived very modestly, drove a secondhand car, really just cared about culture, and yet there were a couple of billion dollars, you know, transactions being conducted in his name. So that was something new we learned. There was another proxy, I can call him that because he's dead, so he can't litigate, called Peter or Pyotr Kolbin. And Kolbin's story is even more extraordinary than Roldugin's story because Kolbin's father knew Putin's father. They would spend summers together in the same village near the Estonian border. And they went to local disco. They tried to pick up local girls. They got into a fight. You know, they were both kind of beaten up. They kind of bonded and so on. And then sort of Putin rose through politics, through the KGB, through spying. And Kolbin became a butcher, which is fine. I mean, you know, I've got nothing against butchers. We need butchers. But then, end of the 90s, early noughties, when Putin becomes president, suddenly Kolbin goes from being a butcher to being an entrepreneur. And he starts acquiring stakes in oil and gas and transportation and pipeline businesses. And within a space of a few giddy years, according to Forbes, it's worth about $500 million.
Well, it is important to say that you are not speaking to me from Moscow. Being a reporter in Moscow can be pretty dangerous these days. You can get beaten up if they're just upset with you. You could disappear or be killed if they're more upset with you. Are you worried about retaliation wherever you are in the world?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I mean, we had a pretty torrid time in Moscow. I mean, I lasted 4 years from 2007 to 2011. But during that period, I was pursuing the kind of stories we've been talking about today, looking at Putin's money, for example, which was absolutely taboo. Also, investigating the whole murky theme of state murder operations, in particular, the plot back in 2006 to poison a Russian dissident in London called Alexander Litvinenko with a cup of tea laced with polonium, this kind of deadly radioactive substance. So pursuing these stories and my punishment, if you can call it that, was, well, I was followed around the streets by obviously sort of KGB, FSB, spies who were trying to eavesdrop on my conversations, which wasn't, I mean, that was kind of mildly amusing. But we had a series of break-ins at the apartment where I live with my family and two small kids. And we were advised by the British Embassy in Moscow that our apartment was bugged, you know, that we were being surveilled, that there was probably video in our bedroom and our living room and everywhere. And moreover, that these kind of house intrusions were happening to American diplomats big time and to American personnel and local Russian hires working for the American embassy. And but it was clear that the Americans and Brits were very much in the crosshairs of the FSB. And what was kind of curious about this is that in Soviet times, KGB officers stationed abroad in New York, say, would use journalistic cover. So they would be, you know, by day, they would be the correspondent for Itar Tass, say. By night, there would be KGB agents in America. And what the Russian regime does is it mirror thinks. So the assumption was that my colleagues from the New York Times were working for the CIA, and that I was therefore a kind of scruffy MI6 operative working under deep cover for The Guardian with perhaps some literary ability, you know, who by day was writing stories for The Guardian website, by night was getting instructions to defame the Russian regime via a flower pot or a rock or a pigeon. I don't know what the fantasy was, but they genuinely seemed to think that. And so I was sort of treated like a kind of troublesome foreign spy.
In 2011, Luke traveled to London to work on The Guardian's coverage of WikiLeaks, which had just been released. In one article, he quoted U.S. diplomatic cables that said, under Vladimir Putin's rule, Russia had become a virtual mafia state. When Luke tried to return to his home in Moscow, he was detained at the airport.
I was put in the cell briefly, and then my visa was cancelled, and then I was deported on the plane I just arrived on. But just to be clear, the real heroes in this story are not Brits and Americans, they're Russians, because for Russians, a different standard applies. And if you're a Russian journalist who investigates corruption, nothing may happen to you or something may happen to you. And that something can range from, you know, your father being arrested or you being busted by the tax police or declared a foreign agent, to, as we saw in the case of Anna Politkovskaya or other brave journalists, to execution. Basically, someone murders you. So it's really grim times for Russian journalism. Some of the reporters I work with on the Pandora Papers, Russian reporters, have fled into exile in the last couple of months. They have left, been forced to leave the country. And I salute those guys because it's an incredibly tough job. And despite the really gloomy, dark political climate in Russia, they keep going.
Few Americans, I'm going to guess, would recognize the face of the current Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky. But it was the famous phone call between the newly elected Ukrainian president and President Trump that resulted in the first impeachment trial against Donald Trump. One of the interesting revelations from Pandora is that there is a connection between Ukraine's president and the influence of oligarchs. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, we actually found a very good story. I think the reason the story involving President Zelensky, president of Ukraine, as you say, is important is because traditionally, whenever we do one of these great leaks, the Kremlin says it is a CIA plot. You know, it's CIA, Western Special Services have done this as part of an information war against Russia. That's always their line. Well, that's fine, but in which case, how do you explain the fact that Zelensky is very much in the mix, you know, with these secret offshore companies, given the fact that he's America's ally? I mean, if it's a CIA plot, it's too subtle for my brain to comprehend because you would leave him out. So that argument doesn't really stack up. But what is kind of ironic and curious about Zelensky is that he was a famous actor. I mean, there was this sort of Trump-like story in his kind of rise as a politician. I mean, actually, it was even a better storyline than that because he played in a popular series called Servant of the People. He played a teacher fed up with the corruption in Ukraine who decides as a complete outsider to run for president and wins. That's the fictional version. That's the Netflix version. And then, of course, he decides he's going to do that in real life. So he founds a political party, also called Servant of the People. He gets a team of novices, of neophytes around him. And he says, hey, I'm going to clean up this corrupt oligarch-inflected swamp. Vote for me.
He's campaigned on an anti-establishment, anti-corruption platform.
It's a departure from the methods of the party bosses and oligarchs that have run this country since independence from the Soviet Union.
This message works. He wins a landslide in the spring of 2019. And, you know, hurrah, the end. Apart from the fact that what we discovered in the Pandora Papers is that he too has a bunch of secret offshore companies. He's declared some of them, but he hasn't declared all of them. And we found one in particular called Moltex, registered in the British Virgin Islands, which he had not declared, which he co-owned with a bunch of his close friends from his TV days. And what was curious about the story was that we had to go to him. We went to everybody weeks in advance before we published and said, look, you know, dear President Zelensky, we found your offshore company. We're thinking about writing a story about this. You know, what is your comment? And we thought we'd get an answer, you know, it's an oversight. I meant to declare it. I didn't. It's not significant, etc. But we got silence for almost a month from Zelensky. And we published this story. I mean, what he also did while he was campaigning on this anti-corruption platform was to give his share of the company to his best friend, who he made his chief of staff. I mean, again, it's going from Netflix. So we're now in West Wing territory here, right? I mean, it's about a bit West Wing-ish, but also a bit rubbish. I mean, you would improve that plot, you know, send the script back, tweak it. But no, it gives it to his best friend, who he brings into government, along with another friend who's involved in this offshore scheme. He makes the head of the SBU intelligence service. So it's like, you know, getting your other offshore buddy to run the CIA and become Bill Burns, you know. I mean, so but what's curious is how maladroit Zelensky has been in dealing with this story. I mean, there was a very good investigative film made about this, which has become the most viewed investigative film in Ukrainian history.
Уяви, одного дня народ обирає тебе президентом.
It's had about 2 million views, where I've got a kind of cameo role because I go stomping around London where Zelensky's friends have bought this expensive apartments and property. And hilariously, one of these properties in the central London is opposite 221B Baker Street. Does that ring any bells with you, Ray?
Yeah.
It's the home of Sherlock Holmes, the world's most famous consulting detective. And literally, this offshore-owned, you know, Zelensky crony place is next to Sherlock Holmes's home. I mean, he could pop over and go to have tea with Mrs. Watson, practically, or hear the violin from wafting over the street, you know. So it's this strange mixture of kind of corruption and farce that we find a lot in the 21st century running through Pandora, running through our stories.
What are some of the places in the world that have benefited as countries have tried to make it harder to hide money? Who are those bottom feeders who kind of wink to the rest of the world and say, come on in?
So we have Monaco with glorious weather, and then we have places like the British Virgin Islands, again, nice food, palm trees, and so on. But also, we have large chunks of the United States. We have Delaware, we have Nevada, we have Wyoming. We have onshore tax havens, actually in America as well. And then also, I'm not just pointing the finger at the US, we have my country, the UK, which is really, one thing we learned from the Pandora Papers, is really at the heart of this offshore industry and is facilitating all this. So this isn't a story of faraway bad guys from Russia or Latin America setting up offshore bank accounts to conceal their sleazy wealth. In fact, everyone is in this. America's role as a leading tax haven is exposed as well. And there are Americans who've got very rich off the back of it.
You've alluded to the tacit cooperation of the British and American financial world. Is it illegal?
The bottom line is that the offshore world, generally speaking, is legal. But the problem is that because it relies on secrecy, because it's multi-layered, because it's complicated, and it's far-flung. So it's very tricky for enforcement agencies. But ultimately, I think it's a question of political will. You know, look, Joe Biden is trying to make multinational corporations pay their taxes. And also, we should try and reform this murky system. Then we could do something about it. But the problem is there are vested interests who don't want to do this. There are American states that don't want to do this because it's very profitable for them. It's a big money spinner. If you're Delaware, why would you change the system? So it's a question of political will. And at the moment, I don't see a time, you know, COVID, where treasuries all over the world are broke. I don't see sufficient political will for this to happen. So What alternative do we have? I mean, as listeners, as voters, as citizens, as journalists, as writers, as people who are concerned about the direction we're going as a planet, and can we change things? I don't know, but we can try. We have to try. We're obliged to try.
Luke Harding is a journalist, writer, and award-winning correspondent with The Guardian. Between 2007 and 2011, he was the paper's Moscow bureau chief until the Kremlin deported him from the country in the first case of its kind since the Cold War. Luke's most recent book is Shadow State: Murder, Mayhem, and Russia's Remaking of the West. You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. If you missed any part of this episode or want to catch up on other international stories, you can download our podcast. Just search for World Affairs, that's one word, on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you recognize this music, you may have been one of the tens of millions of people glued to their screens watching a two-hour takedown of corrupt Russian oligarchs and President Vladimir Putin. The video, released in January, is called Putin's Palace. It was both a journalistic exposé and a strategic move by Alexei Navalny, you know, the anti-corruption activist and Putin nemesis. We asked Luke Harding, who's a former Moscow bureau chief for The Guardian, to explain Navalny's rise to prominence.
Alexei Navalny is, in my opinion, the most significant figure to emerge in Russian politics, Russian oppositional politics, in the post-Soviet era. And he is someone who is there on merit. He began his career as a lawyer, really, someone on the right rather than the left, who grew up in the Soviet Union as a kid, but was not sort of defined by it. Essentially, his coming of age was in the noughties, when he became active in opposition politics, first of all with a group called Yabloko, flirted for a while with what you might call Russian nationalism, took part in a far-right march in Moscow, which is always sort of held against him by his critics, but in essence, I think moved on and away from that. And I first came across him when I was in Moscow in about 2007, 2008, when he was essentially an anti-corruption activist. He was doing things like he was buying shares in state corporations, turning up at shareholder meetings and asking about corrupt deals and about who owned what and so on. And he was trying to expose endemic state corruption in Russia. He blogged, he had a website, he attracted followers and attention, and he started popping up on Echo of Moscow radio.
Алексей Анатольевич, я сразу поправьте.
Максимальный перевод 30 тысяч рублей, минимальный 1 копейка.
This anti-corruption movement started getting bigger and bigger. And then if you fast forward to 2011, 2012, when there were huge protests against Putin after he announced he was coming back for a third presidential term, Navalny started addressing rallies and became a sort of national figure, I would say.
Один человек, Путин. Который вор, коррупционер, лицемер, человек лишённый любых моральных.
And then, of course, the Kremlin decided to move against him, locked up his brother, charged him with various crimes, which I think are not real crimes at all. But for quite a long period, they were confused as to what to do about Navalny. And then, clearly, by the beginning of last year, Putin had just had enough of him and decided in classic KGB style that he would solve this problem by killing Navalny, in essence. This hit squad of FSB agents poisoned him in Siberia by applying Novichok, this lethal nerve agent, to his underpants. Basically, that was supposed to be Act 5. He was supposed to die. The Kremlin was supposed to say, well, it's a terrible accident. We have nothing to do with it. Let's all move on. And of course, against script, Navalny survived. He went to Berlin. He recovered. He denounced Putin. His FSB kill team were exposed. And then he came back. And he knew what would happen. He knew he'd be arrested. And so he flew back. He was arrested. And then, a bit like sort of pressing a button on a doomsday device, he released this video when he had been arrested.
Well, Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny has released a two-hour video investigation into the complex, saying the palace was built for Russian President Vladimir Putin using taxpayer money. The Kremlin has denied those allegations.
The Putin's Palace film by Alexei Navalny was nothing less than a sensation. It was a kind of wonderful and witty excoriating expose by Navalny of the corruption of the Russian elite in general and of Vladimir Putin. It involved a sort of backstory with Navalny retracing Putin's career as a young KGB officer in East Germany.
Сейчас эту ценность можно приобрести в интернете за 3 евро.
And it involved a thesis, which is that actually Putin, for all of his strongman pretensions and his macho stunts and riding topless through the mountains or fishing in Siberia, that essentially, according to Navalny, he is a thieving little man in a bunker, or grandpa, I think he called him. And one of the things that he has built with his stolen fortune, according to Navalny, this is the allegation, is a kind of garish mega palace on the shore of the Black Sea, which has taken years to construct, cost billions of dollars. It's like a sort of palace for a Bond villain, but it's completely tacky. It's got an ice rink, it's got a games room, it's got a pole for pole dancing, it's got a casino, it's got something called an aqua disco. I don't quite understand what that is.
Leaked floor plans of the vast palace, which allegedly includes a casino, a theatre, extensive vineyards, an ice rink, and luxury bathrooms, where even the Italian-made toilet brush costs $800.
This video was a sensation. It's been seen by 115, 120 million people in Russia and around the world. And it works because of Navalny's storytelling genius, his humor, combined with just fantastic investigative journalism. What Navalny was showing was that Putin acquiring money wasn't something that just happened, that it was always in the plan, that basically he was corrupt from the very beginning and tracking this through his career. I mean, essentially, the Navalny thesis is that he moved on as a bureaucrat in St. Petersburg, as an aide to the then mayor, as an upwardly mobile politician himself. And pretty quickly, he graduated from washing machines and car stereos to skimming off money from state contracts or contracts to feed the city of St. Petersburg. And then, of course, by the time he became prime minister and president in 2000, he had, you might argue, a country at his disposal where it was no longer millions of dollars that allegedly he was collecting. It was billions. And it was a tale, the video, that was the tale of how kleptocracy happens, how a group of individuals, in this case, all of them connected with the KGB, can seize a state and then run it for their own private purposes.
Дворец с главного входа. Владимир Путин мнит себя русским императором и ведет себя соответствующе.
Putin's reaction to the film, well, it was classically Putin. He claimed not to have seen it. He said he was very busy, that, you know, his aides had seen it and he'd heard a little bit about it, but the allegations in it were not true. And then one of his old sort of friends from St. Petersburg pops up about a week or two later and says, actually, it's my palace. I've been building it. Nothing to do with Vladimir Vladimirovich.
And in a fresh twist to the Putin palace controversy, Putin's former judo partner says that he owns the palace, which the opposition has accused the Russian president of owning. Russian businessman Arkady Rotenberg today said...
So state TV, of course, you know, shrugged the whole thing off. But I suspect, I mean, I'm not inside Putin's head, you know, I'm not an amateur psychologist, but I suspect that Putin was deeply furious at this film. And I think, among other things, it's driving the Kremlin's current project to clamp down on the internet, to make it, you know, harder and harder for someone like Navalny to release videos of this kind where actually they get traction. Navalny has been shut out for over a decade from formal politics in Russia. He doesn't appear on state TV. Putin won't even say his name. He's that person, that gentleman, that patient from Berlin, et cetera, et cetera. But what he's done is he's sort of circumvented the fact that the Kremlin controls sort of institutional media space by releasing these videos where point at corrupt Kremlin individuals and he will tell a story. And I think Navalny's great gift is, as I said, for storytelling, but also for demystification, that essentially he says this is a corrupt group of individuals and for all of their super patriotism and their nationalism and that America is our enemy, essentially they just want to get rich and hang on to their wealth and spend it on the most ridiculous, bizarre, almost teenage projects. I mean, a super palace on the Black Sea with every whim catered for, from a wine cellar to a pole dance to an aqua disco to a gaming table to a crazy view of the sea. And it was sort of making Putin look ridiculous that's what makes it so potent. And that explains why Putin loathes Navalny with an absolutely personal, pathological hatred. What Navalny succeeded in doing is, in this absolutely manipulated and controlled media environment, he has cut through. People who don't like him in Russia have heard of him. It's supposed to be a one-man show, Russia. There's one action hero, one guy at the top of the news, and it's this short little man called Putin. And suddenly we have another pretender, another protagonist, Navalny.
Пусть их будет 124! Путин!
Navalny's organization has been completely wrapped up in the light of the film. His colleagues have been arrested or forced into exile. The Navalny organization, Anti-Corruption Foundation, no longer exists in any real or physical sense. And Russia has lurched further towards full-blown, well, I would say we've gone beyond authoritarianism. I think we're sort of going towards sort of dictatorship, where any form of dissent against the regime is a crime. Now, Navalny has catalyzed this, I think, in the hope that it will hasten the sort of revolution against Putin. I suspect it won't, but nonetheless, you have to admire the man and you have to admire his bravery.
That was journalist Luke Harding. He was The Guardian's Moscow bureau chief from 2007 until he was deported in 2011. Luke's most recent book is Shadow State: Murder, Mayhem, and Russia's Remaking of the West. In this David and Goliath story, will little Alexei Navalny eventually take down big bad Putin? A new book makes the case that, as effective as he's been in building an opposition, Navalny just might not be the right man for the job. The book is called Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. I recently spoke with its three co-authors, Jan Mati Dolbaum, Morvan Lalouet, and Ben Noble. The Alexei Navalny that emerges from the pages of your book is in turns admirable and kind of a pain in the neck. Tremendous single-minded energy, reckless bravery, strategic flexibility in the face of a powerful enemy under changing circumstances. A lot of the traits you'd want in someone trying to undermine, bring down a comprehensive authoritarian state. A complicated guy, no?
Definitely, and that's the type of portrait that we wanted to provide. We thought that too much of the commentary regarding Alexei Navalny in the West, in the US and the UK media specifically, portrayed him in a very black and white fashion. They told a very simple morality tale, saying he was the good guy and Putin was the bad guy. And what we wanted to do in the book is step back and say, well, hang on, it's a bit more complicated than that. And part of that complication relates to Navalny himself and not only the complicated landscape of Russian politics in the post-Soviet period. So what we try and do in the book is, as objectively as possible, fill in all the nuances that was missing from that commentary, and that, with audiences aware of that complexity and those nuances, bits of the narrative regarding Alexei Navalny might make a bit more sense, including Amnesty International originally labeling him as a prisoner of conscience, but then taking the label away, but then giving it back to him. Those episodes, as we make clear in the book, can be explained if you look at the really varied history of Navalny over the last 20 years.
He floats in and out of Western news coverage, sometimes only when the most outrageous, splashy things happen. What's the state of play right now between Navalny and the Russian state?
He is right now sitting in a prison colony, and he has been able to get some messages out through his lawyers, usually. And he has been talking to the New York Times, for example, has been giving a big interview there. And he has been also writing a piece or dictating a piece to somebody who can actually write it down. That has appeared in The Guardian, in the British newspaper. So he has contact to the outside, and he seems to be in a stable condition, other than earlier this year when he was in severe health problems. But he's still obviously locked up and he can't really act from where he is. And that is exactly what the regime wanted to achieve. He is not in direct contact with his supporters and with Russian society at large. And that is, I think, the biggest problem that he's facing right now.
for a lot of people simply watching from this side of the world, the idea that after his life was saved in Germany, after what can only be described as an assassination attempt through poisoning, you pick up a paper and read, he got on a plane and went back, and you think, he what? Let's talk about last year and the earlier part of this year. Where was Navalny when he first took ill? What was the state of play with between him and the Russian authorities? And take the story from there.
So in August 2020, when Navalny was poisoned, he was touring big cities in Siberia, and he was trying to promote candidates from his movement who were running in several major cities in Siberia, and also trying to promote his tactical voting strategy that's called smart voting. And at the time, of course, Navalny's movement was somehow repressed, and it cannot be said that Navalny was having the time of his life in Russian politics, but we were living at the time in a very different Russia than the one we knew today. There was a movement led by Alexei Navalny, the Foundation Against Corruption. Navalny was free to tour the country. We then learned that he was constantly followed by FSB people. But I think that looking back at the situation, let's say the day before he was poisoned, it was a completely different Russia altogether.
And when you say completely different Russia, Morvan, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think that when Navalny returned to Russia in January of this year, all Russian observers, I would say, were quite shocked and surprised by the breadth and the speed of repression that has fallen on Navalny's movement. And we, in a way, we got accustomed to some sort of equilibrium where Russia is, of course, an authoritarian regime where media and independent political organizations are repressed. But we had never seen a repression of that scale in 20 years of Russian politics. Well, when Navalny returned to Russia, there were several demonstrations to protest against his arrest and him being sent to prison. And more than 10,000 people were arrested. His movement was then completely dismantled. And it can be said, I think, that it was the biggest independent political organization in today's Russia. And this whole organization got wiped off the map in a matter of weeks. And this is something that I think all of us were shocked to witness.
Ben, isn't it in keeping with some aspects of his character that he would do something totally surprising, kind of quixotic, and a little bit doomed?
Yeah, if we're talking about his decision to go back to Russia in January of this year, that was one of the reasons why we wrote the book, to try and explain the features of his character that might make sense of something that wouldn't even pass many people's minds. You know, the idea that you would go back facing the certainty of being arrested and likely facing many years in jail, most people would say, no, okay, I'll stay in Germany, I'll have a comfortable life. But for Navalny, that really was never an option. He is a Russian politician who realizes that to be effective, he needs to be in Russia. He also wanted to support those people who are willing to support him and incur difficulties in their own life by supporting him. And one of the things we do in the book is draw on interviews done by Jan between 2017 and this year with activists and supporters of Navalny in the regions, where you get a picture of quite the lengths that they go to and the difficulties that they encounter when supporting him and when being involved with his movement. But back to Navalny's decision to return to Russia, it very much speaks to this pig-headed almost approach that he takes. He doesn't back down. He has a very forceful character. You know, if he gets in an argument with somebody, he doesn't apologize. He carries on. Some people regard that as him being a bit of a bully. Some people regard that as a sign that he's just a dictator in waiting. We don't think that that's the case. You get a sort of quite consistent image of his character throughout the book. And he's clearly self-confident. He's clearly intelligent. He's eloquent. He's charismatic. And he's the leader of a movement.
Jan, it caught my ear when Ben called Navalny a politician. Because if anything emerges from the pages of your book, it's that being a politician in a place like Russia is like being in a funhouse with distorting mirrors and corridors that don't lead to a predictable place, and a game that it's hard to understand the rules of or to carry on as a politician in a normal way by marshaling support and then bringing that support to the polls and the sort of predictable, traditional thing that politicians try to do. Is it possible to be a politician in the conventional sense of the word in Russia in 2021?
I think that was an excellent characterization you just gave of Russian politics as a funhouse with distorting mirrors, because that's exactly what the intent was before, as my colleagues have just outlined, the turn towards more traditional authoritarianism. It was to have the formally democratic institutions in place, but to distort them or to manipulate them in order to bring about the results that were desired by the political elite. And that these manipulations could look very differently from one instant to the other. The main goal was just to keep Putin and his party in power. But what delivered that goal was very different over time, right? So at one point, Navalny was allowed to take part in elections. He was on the ballot in the Moscow mayoral elections in 2013, because then the strategy was to have somebody credibly oppositional on the ballot in order to show that this is actually a democratic election. And then he got 27%, and that was a little too dangerous, perhaps, for the Kremlin. And so the strategy changed, and they never let himself be on the ballot ever again. So this is exactly what happens in what we call in political science electoral authoritarianism, or hybrid regimes, where formally democratic institutions exist, but they are undermined in a very ad hoc way in order to preserve power. I think one problem for the Russian opposition was that the turn from a perhaps rather democratic regime under Yeltsin into a autocratic regime under Putin happened very, very gradually. So many people who were active in the opposition were still sort of in the 90s narrative to think, yeah, we can actually be a party with a political profile and we don't have to support any oppositionists. We want to support our particular ideology, right? And that's what we still see sometimes in the Russian opposition, that people are not ready to act tactically, that they want their own political profile to be voted for, the liberals, the socialists, whoever it is, rather than recognizing the changed situation. And that is something that Navalny has been campaigning for, that now the real goal should be to subvert the authoritarian regime and only after that care about political positions or ideology.
By talking about politics, politicians, the practice of political persuasion, are we letting the Russian people themselves off the hook? Don't they get a role in this? You're very thorough in explaining how the powers that be control the field of battle. But internationally reputable, methodologically sound public opinion researchers from time to time have found that Putin's pretty popular. Not all the time and not everywhere, but he's not Ceausescu. He's not Lukashenko, opposed and despised by the overwhelming majority of his people and holding on in spite of them. Do we have to be careful about keeping in mind that, you know, there's a certain value for stability and a certain fear of instability that keeps Putin in play legitimately? That a lot of Russians on the street would say, yeah, you know, we think that the guy's done some good things.
Definitely. And in the book, we don't shy away from that conclusion. We make it very clear that the polling data shows that Putin himself is popular, if only because people associate him with stability versus the chaos and the instability of the 1990s, soon after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So we don't shy away from that. And it's really why the question mark in the title of the book is so important. It's Navalny, Putin's nemesis, Russia's future question mark.
I think when we look at Putin's popularity and why he can be genuinely popular in Russia is that this popularity, I think we all agree on this, was based on him delivering a certain number of goods to the Russian population, stability, economic growth, growth in real wages, etc. And if, as we have all indications to believe now, it becomes more and more difficult to deliver these goods, now it raises the question, is this popularity forever if what it's based on cannot necessarily last forever? So I think that this can give us maybe some glimmer of hope as to how things might be changing in the near future. Maybe Jan wanted to add something.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. We never know when things are changing before they actually start changing, or we hardly can know that. And that's certainly the case in here too. But what we also need to consider is what, in the event that the population would suddenly lose its faith in Putin to a greater degree, what could replace him or who could replace him? And of course, Putin has been very, or the whole regime has been very careful in eliminating any potential independent, different source of power or somebody who, you know, nobody comes to mind when you think who could replace Putin credibly. And that's, of course, by intention. So then the question is, what would be there? What would take its place? And Navalny has been operating on this exact idea to provide a stable and an independent and a forceful movement and political organization that could jump in into such a power vacuum, that could provide a counter elite. But that is now being wiped out. And so the question is, what could be there? And we don't know.
Ah, but he's also got to live. I mean, in order to be that for Russia's future, he's got to live. And that was one of the things that made the decision to return to Russia right after his recovery in the hospital so surprising. I once had lunch with Viktor Yushchenko, a man ravaged by the poisoning, weak, severely hampered by this attempt to kill him. You know, the world is full of stories of opposition leaders who mysteriously die in jail. Ben Noble, in order for Navalny to be part of Russia's future, and I guess making your question mark even more necessary, is the fact that he's got to be not reckless, but strategic.
Definitely. And Dmitry Peskov, who's the Kremlin spokesperson, recently said, was asked, you know, what's going to happen with Navalny in prison? And he said, he gave a rather vague formulation saying, well, let's hope he doesn't die. Which you can imagine is a damning indictment of the state of the Russian penal system, that you could be under any doubt that somebody in that situation might have an uncertain future. And that was really an interesting moment where you get a sense that, you know, Navalny is Putin and the Kremlin's nemesis. There really is no love lost. And so that might explain why Peskov said something, you know, as a public relations professional, that didn't sound very PR friendly. You know, when you said before, you know, he's got to remain alive in order for this to work, I was thinking you weren't talking about Navalny. I was thinking you were talking about Putin. And that's an interesting, you know, if we're talking about a system that is a personalist autocracy, Putin, because he doesn't want somebody challenging him in power, has created a system that is at once heavily centralized, but it, in the long term, makes it quite fragile. Because if Putin is taken out of the equation, what's going to fill that gap? Which is one of the reasons why during the coronavirus, he has either been well away from people or they've had to quarantine for 2 weeks before seeing him. It becomes a, you know, a national security issue if Putin were to get coronavirus. And that gives us another way of looking at the regime. But you mentioned something before about what could challenge the regime. And in the run-up to the recent elections, the Kremlin sustained this narrative of foreign interference. And they were saying things like, you know, Navalny and his movement, we might be repressing them, but you don't need to worry because they're not good Russians. They're purely puppets of Western interests. We've also seen that narrative being used against independent media in the country, increasingly labeled foreign agents. And so what the Kremlin is trying to do is saying any criticism, any opposition isn't coming from honest, true Russians. It's just a sign of the West trying to interfere. And that's a really sort of effective, powerful narrative because they can say, you know, Navalny calling for democratic change, he's just, you know, being paid by the State Department to say that. What the Kremlin finds much trickier is convincing Russians that with rising food prices, they shouldn't be going out onto the streets to protest. And I think, you know, an economic challenge like rising inflation, that's the type of thing that really could challenge the current political leadership. And it's why we saw such nervousness in the run-up to the State Duma elections, the parliamentary elections, because food prices were rising, the government knew that they couldn't just spin that as a sign of the West interfering in the domestic sovereign affairs of Russia. So we saw the government intervening and telling companies, prices better stabilize, because if they don't, there will be consequences. Going forward, though, I think that is one of the key challenges. Yes, it doesn't relate to Alexei Navalny, but it does relate to one of the ways in which the current regime might feel a great sense of unease and uncertainty.
Jan Matti-Dolbaum, as you look down the near future, which in a case of a country like Russia that's so dependent on resource extraction and external macroeconomic forces as to whether Putin's really delivering for his people, does much change? As long as Putin's around and apparently healthy, does anything change?
We, as academics, usually don't make predictions. We've supplied in the book and also a little bit in the talk here the ingredients that we would need for something to change. But whether these ingredients will actually combine in the way that would be necessary for change, we cannot predict, right? So we would need a rapid and strong decrease in the trust in the president. That could happen through some economic crisis, for example. We would also need something happening with the idea that many Russians harbor that political engagement isn't very useful. So we would need, you know, an increase sort of in the attraction of or attractiveness of engaging and going out on the street. And we would also need something to happen with the elites. The consensus, the strong consensus within the elite that Putin is the major arbiter of things should also change for something to happen. So when we see all of these ingredients come together, then of course something can change pretty quickly. Whether that's going to be the case, we don't know.
Ben Noble, you wanted to get a last word in?
So I was just going to say that there is something changing, and that's generational replacement. And the Kremlin knows that. They know that the people who have lived experience of the Soviet Union, that the Kremlin, when they can play on that nostalgia for a quote-unquote more stable, predictable time, those people are dying off. The generation is. And so this younger generation, without a lived experience of the Soviet Union, with different ideas maybe of the role the West would play, not necessarily all positive, but just different ideas. That is one source of change. And it's why the Kremlin is doubling down on patriotic education to try and educate this newer generation of the glories of the Soviet years. And it really, it's a sign that the Kremlin is trying to find a new way to legitimize their rule. And it's based on a nostalgia, increasingly for people who never lived through that particular time. So they're having to recreate the past in a desperate attempt to try and secure their future.
Ben Noble is a lecturer in Russian politics at University College London and an associate fellow at Chatham House. He joined me along with Morvan Lalouette, a PhD candidate at the University of Kent, and Jan Matti-Dolbaum, a research fellow at the University of Bremen in Germany. Their book is Navalny, Putin's Nemesis, Russia's Future. You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. If you enjoyed today's show, you might want to catch my upcoming conversation with Fiona Hill, the former top Russia advisor in the Trump White House. She believes U.S. democracy is still under attack and is potentially headed down the same autocratic path as Putin's Russia. You can participate in our talk live on Tuesday, November 16th at 11 a.m. Pacific. Just register on our website at worldaffairs.org. And if you can't make it, don't worry. You can listen on our podcast starting November 20th. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about this episode? Do you have ideas for future stories? Please email us at feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Levi Bridges, Andrew Stelzer, and Matteo Schimpf. Matteo also mixed and mastered the show. Joanne Jennings is our executive producer and editor. Elise Manoukian is our associate producer. And our CEO is Philip Young. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.